Welcome to The Point. I'm Amy Vince, producer of the program. First, we discuss brain science and research. We begin with a conversation Mindy recorded earlier this week.
For decades, science fiction has featured artificial intelligence computers that challenge human intelligence. Think back to the 1968 Stanley Kubrick film 2001, A Space Odyssey, and the computer character HAL. While algorithms are allowing computers to process large data sets, they have yet to come close to the human brain's ability to learn. But is it just a question of time? Joining us to answer that question and others is Stan Dahan. He's the director of the Cognitive Neuroimaging Unit in France and author of the new book, How We Learn, Why Brains Learn Better Than Any Machine for Now. Welcome to the program.
Hello.
Yeah. In the book, you introduce us to a 7-year-old boy, Philippe, who, tell us a little bit more about him and how meeting him changed your notions about how we learn.
This little boy was in a hospital in Brazil, and he was hit by a bullet, and he became tetraplegic at the age of 3 and blind, so crippled and blind. When I went to see him in his room, I expected to see the worst, and in fact, I realized that, no, he was a very happy child. He was, of course, surrounded by a lot of nurses and parents that fed his eager his ability to learn, and he became excellent in languages. He was already trilingual when I saw him at the age of 6. This is a living proof, first of all, that the brain is modular and that the brain can learn even in the presence of huge impairments. The brain is not really just a sensory machine, it's a conceptual machine that has specific abilities that are unique to humans, the ability to conceptualize and to verbalize through language.
And you think, you mentioned this, you think of Helen Keller, who was both deaf and blind.
Yes, unfortunately, the cases of blind children also provide a remarkable example of plasticity. In fact, in the book, I describe some of the research that we did with blind mathematicians. Can you imagine that?
Yeah.
There was, at one moment, a blind mathematician who held the chair of Newton in Cambridge. He was a top-notch mathematician. We scanned another such mathematician in the lab. What we found was that you can be a perfectly normal mathematician. These blind mathematicians use the same areas of the brain. They have developed the same amount of in-depth mathematical knowledge. In fact, they even recycle their visual cortex. The cortex, which normally is involved in vision, is become reoriented towards language and math in blind people. This is a good case of brain plasticity. Mm.
Your research found that babies are born with core knowledge. What is some of the knowledge they come into the world with? And were you able to determine the presence of core knowledge in infants?
Core knowledge is something that can be really abstract. We think of modules for knowing number, for instance, or probability, or geometrical shapes, or the sense of space, or the sense of people. The idea that people are different from objects. All of these different aspects of knowledge are present in little infants. It's rather a surprise, I think. We tend to think of the baby as a blank slate, but one of the major topics of the book is that this is not true. The baby's brain is already extremely well organized. All of the major circuits are there in the brain. We've been doing brain imaging experiments in the lab with 2-month-old babies, and they're already very well organized. And in fact, yes, it's probably present not only from birth, but in fact in the last trimester of gestation, the last 3 months. The baby is already hearing in utero. It's able to process some visual information. And these basic modules that can be very abstract for number, for instance, are already laid down under genetic guidance. There's a lot of genetic endowment in the human species.
We've often heard that there are different kinds of learners, visual, oral, verbal, physical. Does your research back up these differences in learning styles?
Not at all. And we all think now that the idea of learning styles is just what we call a neuromyth, a myth of neuroscience. In fact, all babies have the same sort of brain architecture. For instance, I was just talking about number sense. The finding is that we all have it at birth, and it's exactly the same for boys and girls. There is no difference between boys and girls in this respect. But it's the same for, you know, vision versus audition versus touch. It's not true that there are some learners that prefer vision and others that prefer speech. In fact, we all benefit from multimodal information. We all benefit when information is presented both in words and visually. And that's just an example. In general, the algorithms of learning that I describe in my book are true of all humans. The human brain has a genetic endowment for learning, which has a sort of universal learning algorithm.
So is there a peak time for learning for the human brain?
Yes, there is, of course. We speak of sensitive periods. In fact, the childhood is a wonderful period for brain plasticity. The brain is much more mobile. When we speak of brain plasticity, you have to understand that we are literally talking about cells moving. The trees that are called the dendrites that form the ballpark of the neuron can move just like the branches of a real tree, and they can grow. Some synapses can grow or retract. It's so fast in young children that when you look at a child for 1 second, several million synapses have changed in just 1 second. So that's a peak period of plasticity. After that, it decreases, first slowly, and then at the time of puberty, there is really a sharp decrease in brain plasticity. It does not completely disappear, but in some systems, like the sensory systems of the brain, the systems that allow us to hear sounds of language, for instance, it really seems to vanish, so we can no longer hear the differences that are not used in our language, for instance. We become, in a certain sense, deaf. So we should really capitalize on this early brain plasticity of the child to provide optimal stimulation.
In the book, you emphasize children exposed to a rich environment filled with verbal stimulation, access to puzzles, games, and stories are markedly different than children who don't have that exposure. What do those differences look like when you examine the brain?
Well, people have, for instance, scanned children that were exposed to stories at that time and those that were not. And the differences appear in the circuits for language. We talk about the white matter of the brain, which is essentially the long-distance fibers that connect different areas of the brain, can be as long as 10 centimeters. And these long-distance fiber tracts are stronger, they are more efficient in the brains of children who have been exposed to more language. We're talking about huge differences in exposure. There are some children that have, several tens of times more exposure to language than others. And we know that this predicts their ability to learn to read, for instance, when they enter school. Likewise, we know that exposure to board games, such as Snakes and Ladders, for instance, will have an important effect on the ability to acquire mathematics later on. So the brain comes prepared, there's a genetic endowment, but then a key factor is the enrichment of the environment to feed this learning system.
Does it make a difference in brain development if children receive stimulation from a human or if it comes primarily through technology?
Ah, this is one of the cutting edges of research at the moment. The human brain seems to be special in its ability to learn in a social context. So machines are not so efficient. Babies learn better from humans because humans orient their attention. There is this phenomenon of shared attention. The baby will look at the caretaker, look at the eyes of the caretaker, grasp what the caretaker is attending to, and share the same amount of attention and learn from that attention. This is something that machines do not imitate so far. So there is not the same amount of learning in most cases from a machine. I'm not saying that computers are dangerous for children. I don't think so. I think there can be learning. But the most efficient learning is still with a human with whom you share a sort of contingent interaction. The child-parent interaction is absolutely crucial.
Many schools are promoting a growth mindset approach to learning. Can you talk about the differences between a growth and a fixed mindset, and if there's evidence that a growth mindset is a better approach to learning?
Yes, there is in fact growing evidence in favor of this idea of growth mindset, even though it's still a little bit debated. What we are talking about is how you consider yourself as a learner. One idea is that some people are gifted and others are not gifted. And this is the sort of static or fixed mindset idea. It's wrong. In fact, the correct view is the growth mindset is that everybody can learn. We all have the same learning algorithm. Some learn faster than others, that's for sure, but we all can learn. And everybody needs to make an effort. So the finding has been that if you tell that to kids and you tell that to teachers, you tell them that every kid can learn, that it's a matter of rehearsal and, you know, going to it day after day, the learning is better, the learning is more efficient. The idea of being gifted or not gifted is actually detrimental both to kids who are good and to kids who are bad at school. The kids who are already behind at school get discouraged by the idea that they're not gifted. But even the kids who are gifted, they also get behind because they think that they don't have to work, which is not true. Everybody needs to make an effort in order to learn. So we should really move to this idea of a growth mindset. We all can learn.
Why is quality of sleep so important in our brain's ability to learn? And are there ways to maximize the learning that happens while we sleep?
Sleep is a very important aspect of the learning algorithm, and that's really an important discovery of the past decades. When we sleep, the brain rehearses. It's not just sitting there doing nothing. It's actually replaying the information that it got during the previous days. And by replaying it, it's relearning it in new ways. It can even make discoveries during sleep. You know, there are many anecdotes about scientists making discoveries during sleep, but in fact, this happens to all of us. We discover new ways of linking the information that we get during the day. So yes, there is evidence that if you sleep better, you are going to learn better. There's also evidence, for instance, that if adolescents are allowed to sleep a little bit later in the morning, they become better learners. We should really pay attention to sleep. There are lots of children these days that are sleep deprived, and this has an impact on their ability to learn.
If you had one message for educators interested in having the biggest impact on their students' learning, what would that message be?
Well, I think they should study the four pillars of learning. The idea of attention, I think, is essential. Teachers need to be the people who guide the kids' attention. So they must decide in advance where the child's attention should be focused. I'll give you an example. I worked a lot on the acquisition of reading. We know now that the child's attention needs to be focused on the level of letters and how the letters correspond to sounds. This is the so-called phonics method. If the child's attention is focused on the whole word, then essentially the wrong brain circuits get activated and there's very little learning going on. So by orienting attention to the proper level, the teacher can have a huge impact on the amount of learning.
How does artificial intelligence and the ability of machines to analyze and adapt their behavior compare to the human brain?
It's a huge question. Of course, a lot of artificial intelligence these days is inspired by the brain. And when we compare directly, we find that, for instance, the object recognition software that we have, or the speech recognition software that we have, corresponds rather well only to the first quarter of a second of brain processing, the unconscious process by which we recognize a face or an object or a voice. Beyond that, I think AI has a lot to learn still from the brain. But this is happening. So, for instance, now there are AI systems that actually learn to attend. Attention has become a hot topic in artificial intelligence, and there are systems now that have an active attention system that amplifies the information that the system deems relevant. And the evidence is that these systems with attention learn much, much better than systems without attention. So I think we're going to see a sort of a race. There's brain scientists discovering new properties of the brain and artificial intelligence engineers trying to implement these properties in their systems. I think that this is going to go on for the next century because the brain is really an extraordinarily complex system and we are far from completely grasping how it does this amazing learning.
So do you actually foresee a time then when computers can outpace the human brain in learning?
In principle, I don't see any reason why this should not happen. The brain is a machine, for all we know. It's a machine that's been designed by evolution. There was no designer other than the ability to be efficient. So we are learning to copy it, and we may even become better at copying it than the actual brain. We see this already, for instance, in the game of Go or chess. These games have been completely taken over by the machine. And now there is no human that can beat the machine at these games. What we do not have so far is a flexible machine, which is capable of the flexible learning that occurs in a young child. There is also the notion of discovery learning, where we discover a theory of the world, scientific learning. These are the new challenges for AI.
Does the older brain learn differently than developing brains? What would be your advice for adults who are interested in learning something new?
All of the principles or the pillars of learning that I outlined for children are true also for the adult brain. It's just that we need more time in most cases. But for instance, the idea of being engaged in the learning rather than passive is extremely important. If you have a fixed period of time to study, well, you should not do only study, but you should actually study and test, study and test. Because when you test yourself, you actually gain error feedback that you can use to correct yourself. Study, test, and then sleep. These are the same exact ingredients as in children, just you need a little bit more rehearsal and a little bit more effort.
Stan Duhan, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
Stan Duhan's book is titled How We Learn, Why Brains Learn Better Than Any Machine for Now. We'll post more at our website, capeandislands.org.
You're listening to The Point. Up next, can exercise increase the production of new brain cells in adults? Scientist Sam Ahmed has the story in this piece produced by Carry the One Radio, a science podcast based out of the University of California, San Francisco.
Okay, there I was, 9 years old, and my brother and I had to go to the gas station across the street from my uncle's insurance office in Philly. I can't remember what we were supposed to buy, but I do remember everything else. I remember waiting at the sidewalk with my brother for the cars to pass on our left, and I remember that as soon as the last car went by, I yelled out, "Race to the finish line, last one's a rotten egg," and I ran across the street as fast as I could. My brother didn't move. He remembered that Baltimore Avenue is a two-way street, and he saw the cars coming from the other side. I wasn't so lucky. There was a loud, rubbery sound as the car's front bumper made contact with my skinny little 9-year-old body, and it threw me under a black SUV. I went chin first into the asphalt, and I rolled around and scraped my knees and elbows. The guy that hit me jumped out of the car and yelled, "Call an ambulance, call an ambulance." He was a round guy with a big black beard, and I remember thinking, this guy looks just like my neighbor. Someone else who saw the whole thing picked me up and rushed me into my uncle's office. I remember looking over my shoulder as the door was closing and seeing the man who I thought was my neighbor drive away. The next thing I know, cops and firemen were on the scene and I was being questioned by a police officer. I don't remember what he was asking me, but I do remember looking down at the blood on my knees and feeling really embarrassed because my mom had made me wear these super tiny navy blue shorts with sky blue stripes, and I remember thinking, man, I wish I had cooler pants on. That was almost 20 years ago, and I still remember it every time I cross the street. And now I always, always look both ways for traffic, no matter what.
I can remember not too long ago, I couldn't find my way.
Hello and welcome to Carry the One Radio, the science podcast. My name is Sam Ahmed. We humans have the ability to mentally time travel to a specific moment in our past, like me in the car accident. Our memories, they help us adapt to the world we live in, and they guide our future behaviors. And all of them, all of our memories, are supported by a living network of brain cells. The thing is, until recently, it was thought that the number of brain cells, the number of neurons we have, is set at birth, meaning that adults can only start losing neurons. This means that some of you out there right now have fewer neurons at this moment than when you started listening to this podcast. But today we challenge that myth. We caught up with a scientist who works on adult neurogenesis, the birth of new neurons. His name is Dr. Gary Westbrook.
Gary Westbrook, I'm a senior scientist at the Volum Institute in Portland.
Gary studies how neurons communicate, and specifically in a brain region that is good at quickly learning memories, the hippocampus. It's so fast that you can remember something that only happened a single time. And there's something else that's special about the hippocampus.
We're interested in that particular region because that's one of the few areas in the adult brain where new neurons are continuously made during life, and we've been studying the process by which those new neurons develop and integrate themselves into the functional circuitry of the adult brain. So it's a way of looking at how we can sort of rejuvenate brain function even in adult animals.
The new neurons that are born in the hippocampus stay in the hippocampus, and they probably help us make new memories. But not all of these new cells make it.
About 50% of them actually make it. Like many cells in the brain, more cells are born than actually survive into the final process. So these new cells in the hippocampus, about 50% make it, about 50% die. We don't actually know the reason for that. There are theories about that. One of the simplest theories is the idea that one needs to make the proper connections in order to survive, sort of a survival of the fittest kind of mechanism, that if you don't make the appropriate connections with your other neurons or other cells in the environment, then you don't receive the signals that you need to survive. The ones that make it seem to integrate normally and seem to be particularly connected with as new memories are formed. So they seem to be preferentially involved as we learn new information, which is a particularly interesting part of the problem.
And in mice and rats, thousands of these new neurons are born every day in the hippocampus.
We still really don't know what part the new cells play versus the cells that have been there, the so-called mature cells. So we're still working out which groups play what roles in what and what situations. For a number of years, we really weren't sure whether this happened in humans. But just earlier this year, a study came out that shows that definitively this does happen in humans, in adults. So it seems like this is a process that isn't restricted to experimental animals like mice, but also is something that's going on in us.
Gary uses fluorescent proteins to label the new neurons. This makes it easy for him to count and characterize them. He can then put the mouse in different experiments and ask, what causes more neurons to be born? And until Gary started working on this problem, it wasn't actually clear what would trigger more cells to be born.
It turns out, however, that we can stimulate the production of new cells through a variety of mechanisms. One of the simplest ones is physical exercise that actually produces a pronounced increase in the number of these cells. It's also sort of interesting that if you look at just the number of cells, let's say, in a young mouse versus a much older mouse, and at rest, there are many fewer cells in the older mouse. But if you stimulate or have that older mouse exercise, their actually response to exercise is greater in the older animal. There's a very robust response suggesting that the sort of capacity to respond is retained even in the older animals.
So the mice are put on a regime of elliptical, maybe some free weights and a little yoga, and they're all set, right?
So what we do with the mice is not so different from your local gym club. So what we do with the mice is put a running wheel in the cages. And so it's voluntary running. It's not enforced. But we do keep track of it. So we put a little counter on the wheel so we know how many revolutions per day that these mice run. So they will do that voluntarily. Which might be harder to do in humans. Some humans will voluntarily exercise and some won't, right? So it doesn't seem like this requires Olympic athletes, but just modest levels of exercise seem to be sufficient.
This is a hot field, and we still don't know exactly what these newly born cells are doing. We don't know what causes them to integrate into the existing circuits. We don't even understand why exercise increases their production. It just does. That's where science lives, on the edge of what is known and what is unknown.
One can take this to thinking about human behavior in interesting ways in terms of, I'm talking about physical exercise, but there are other forms of intellectual and mental exercise as well that appear to stimulate the production of these cells. So this is all correlation. It doesn't prove those cells are actually critical in the function of the brain, but it's very suggestive that, in fact, they're playing an important role and can be stimulated with things like physical exercise.
Thanks for listening to Carry the One Radio. We do our best to bring science straight to your ears. Our program today was produced by Dimitri Rumis and me, Sama Ahmed, with help from Brian Siebel and Stephen G. Financial support for the show is provided by our science producers, Liz Wayne and Thomas Voronowitz, who are supporting us through our crowdfunding campaign at patreon.com/carrytheone. Also, big shout out to another one of our Patreon supporters and one of my childhood friends, Jennifer Conard, who loves to run. She's probably running right now. Keep growing new neurons, Jen, and thanks for supporting our show. If you listen to us on iTunes, don't forget to take a second and write us a review. It's a way for the folks over at iTunes to figure out what shows they should promote. The more positive reviews we have, the more people will find out about us, which means more people will hear what scientists are discovering. We're also on Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud, and all that good stuff. And we have our own website, www.ctoradio.org. CTO stands for Carry the One. And if you feel the urge to go running right now, please, please look both ways before crossing the street. But before you go, here's a little more from Dr. Gary Westbrook.
Unfortunately, I've been a runner for 40 years, and I don't know if it's helped my brain or not. It's not done such good things for my hips and knees, but I think it's done good things for my sort of mental health, if not for the actual performance of my own brain. So, you know, that's an aside from my scientific interests, I think. I think exercise is a great way of helping your mental health, let alone its maybe more discrete physical impacts on your brain.
That piece came to us from Carry the One Radio, a science podcast based out of the University of California, San Francisco.